to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. We are at the end of an extended section where Paul gives instructions about worship. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 26, which in the Red Orange Pew Bible, if you don't have your own Bible, is in the back half on page 176. 1 Corinthians 14, we're going to cover verses 26 through 40 tonight. You all know we're about at the end of this book, so it's helpful to remind ourselves this whole book is written to address problems in the Corinthian church, and we've addressed numerous problems, but a large section has been devoted by Paul to problems going on in the worship. Chapters 12 through 14 are all about addressing the chaos and disruption that has occurred in Corinthian worship, primarily because of the pride of some who assume their gift of tongues makes them more super spiritual than everyone else. So you have to go back a few weeks when Mike started this ball rolling with chapter 12, that we had Paul address people who were abusing their gifts, thinking they were superior to others, and Paul says, no, every gift is important because you're a body. Every member matters. Then you might recall chapter 13, where Paul says, I want to show you a more excellent way, the way of love, because love is meant to be that which is ministered through all the gifts, and the gifts without love are nothing. So if love isn't at the center of their expression of gifts together in corporate worship, then they really haven't accomplished anything that has to do with the gospel. Then we move into chapter 14, and we looked at the first half last week, where Paul wants to say that what goes on in worship must be intelligible. It must be in such a way that people are edified, that they're built up. And that is the reason why he says if people are going to speak in tongues, there needs to be an interpretation. And then he concludes by saying, I'd rather speak five clear words of prophecy than 10,000 words in a tongue. Why? Not because he undermines tongues. He sees it as valuable. He himself participates in that gift. But he understands that the community is there to build one another up, and the gifts that are expressed ought not be for one's own self-building, which is what tongues is, but it ought to be for the encouragement and the edification of all. It's then that he moves into our final section on worship. And when we get back from the Christmas break, Lord willing, you'll notice we move into the final section, the biggest problem of all, and that is some in the Corinthian church are saying, resurrection? Nah, didn't happen. He's going to address that last. So this is the second to last big problem, and now he's concluding his section on worship in the church by trying to create a sense of order. It's been chaos, and he wants to give them guidelines on order. And you've got to realize, we're going back to the inception of the church. There were no seminaries. There were no bulletins. There was no order of worship. There was no lectionary. There was nothing that we take for granted that gives us a sense of order and structure. It was a free-for-all. Who knew what the Spirit was doing in the church and how it might both resemble Israel and its synagogues and its temple, and how it might not resemble those things and be a brand new thing. So there wasn't a clear sense of what kind of structure should be in place for orderly worship. Paul's going to give, in probably the most explicit way he does in all of his letters, Paul's rules of order. You've all heard of Robert's rules of order. For some reason, we give Robert the esteem of being the one who can tell us how to run church. I don't know why the heck we do that. Paul has much better rules of order than Robert ever did. Paul has some rules of order here when he says in verse 26, what should be done then, my friends? What should worship look like? When you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, literally it's a teaching, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. So that's a lot of gifts there he's throwing out. You come together, some people are singing songs, someone comes with a lesson. That is some sustained biblical reflection. Someone's put some work into teaching, if you will. There's a revelation, which would have to do with prophecy. Someone's speaking a word of edification or encouragement or comfort or of challenge. And then there's a tongue. That's that spiritual ecstasy, that prayer language. And there is an interpretation. All of these things are elements in worship in the Corinthian church. And he says, when you come together, everyone's bringing their gifts to bear for the whole community. Well, here's the general ruling principle. Let all things be done for building up. Whatever goes on, whatever gifts are expressed, the same general rule applies. Everything must be done for the good of the whole. Everyone should be edified. The possibility for people to understand and to benefit and to grow and to learn should be at the center of all of the gifts and their expressions. So, Paul's trying to establish order. He wants to give some rules of order. And the reason why that's necessary, we all know, is if you don't have order, you have chaos. And Paul's already experienced the chaos they have going there, and he's already given some directions to that end. So that you need order to prevent chaos, but too much order stifles the spirit. It's just one of those tightropes we're always walking on, that if you have too many rules, you can just choke the life out of a community. I mean, your family doesn't run simply by this rule, that rule, that rule, that rule. There's a dynamic, there's a love, there's an expression of gifts, there is this sense of organism, of life. And yet, there are rules that must be referred to every once in a while, like we're going to eat at the table or other such things. There are rules that you keep, but the rules are there to facilitate life, not to stifle it. And the tightrope that every church leader walks on is too many rules create a bureaucracy and stifle and choke the life out of an organism. But not enough rules leads to chaos and disorganization. So how do you walk that fine line? And Paul's going to give his best attempt at walking that fine line, because there are some self-indulgent abuses he needs to address. And he also wants to create with his rules a way for everyone to be able to use their gifts to be built up together in community. So the way to look at this final section of chapter 14 is it's Paul's rules. And he's going to give three sets of rules for three sets of people. He's going to give rules for tongue speakers, because tongues, he's going to assume, are a part of worship as long as there's an interpretation. He's going to give rules for prophets, people who give a revelation or a word of encouragement or a word of upbuilding. And then in the most controversial section in this book, he's going to give rules for what on the surface looks like rules for women, but I'm going to argue it's something a little bit more than just that. So, we're about to come to the single most controversial section in 1 Corinthians, for sure. It may be Paul's most controversial paragraph in all of his letters. And what we're going to try to do is see how it fits within the context, because I'm convinced of this. If you read that controversial section on its own, you're going to write Paul off as a misogynist. You're just going to write him off. But if you understand it in context, you'll get at least a clear perception of the order Paul's trying to create. So, we're going to go through these one by one. First, he has rules of order for tongue speakers. Verse 27. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be only two, or at most three, and each in turn, and let one interpret. You see the rules? I mean, they're just as plain as you can be. If there's going to be some tongue speaking, two, at most three, so that tongues doesn't dominate the worship. It's not the only thing that goes on. And one at a time. And that one needs to be interpreted so that all understand. So he's giving some rules, one, two, or three, at the most three, each in turn, let one interpret. Verse 28. But if there is no one to interpret, let them be silent in the church and speak to themselves and to God. So the rules, two at the most three, in turn, not everybody at once. And if someone's going to speak in tongues, there needs to be an interpretation for the benefit of all. Otherwise, the person speaking in tongues needs to be silent, to keep it between themselves and God. Now, that phrase, be silent, is what is important, because he's going to say in the controversial passage, wives, be silent. All right? Notice right now, he's telling tongue speakers, both male and female, in order to keep order, in order for there not to be chaos, if you're going to speak in tongue and no one is going to interpret, then you need to be silent. And even if you have interpretation, two or at the most three, and not two at once, only one at a time. Now, as a parenthesis, what's interesting about tongues here is Paul makes it very clear his understanding of that spiritual language, the language of the heart, that communication with God as he sees it, is something legitimate, but he never sees it as something that is outside of one's control. He understands that you can choose not to speak. That if there's going to be no interpretation, be silent. Because in Paul's understanding, if the Spirit of God is at work, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. And if there's not self-control, the Spirit's not at work. This is not just an ecstasy where there's just a complete loss of control for Paul. His understanding of this spiritual language is you can keep silent if necessary. Because he's ordering them to, for the sake of the good of the whole. I find that interesting because Paul is deeply committed to tongues as a legitimate spiritual gift, but he never sees it as something that causes someone to lose a sense of their ability to choose and to be controlled. So that's his rules for the tongue speakers. The rules for the prophets are very similar with some nuance and changes. Verse 29. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. So again, two, at the most three. Paul doesn't want prophecy to dominate the worship. That shouldn't be the only, it shouldn't be 10 prophets in a row. Two, or at the most three, and let the others weigh what is said. He never says the other prophets. I suggest that he's saying, let those in the church weigh what is said. To be, as some people say, good Bereans, they're evaluating, they're thinking, they're listening critically, they're engaged. They're not just assuming that the words that are spoken are infallible. They are instead engaged with them in a deep way that is both absorbed and also critical. So he says, let the prophets, one, two or three at the most, and then verse 30, if a revelation's made to someone else sitting nearby, in other words, someone else wants to prophesy, let the first person be silent. So, the way I read this, and other translations make this less clunky, the idea is the same idea as the tongues, each in their own turn. So that if you feel like you have a prophetic revelation to give, well, let the first person be done. Let them be done speaking, and then you can speak, or maybe let them get done, and then you can weigh in. But again, it's one at a time in order to keep order. Otherwise, it's the chaos and confusion of people talking over one another. It's our daily news broadcast. It's just everyone speaking all at the same time. He says, I don't want that. There needs to be order. There needs to be structure. People can have their time to speak, and others need to listen, and listen critically and in an absorbed way. Verse 31, for you can all prophesy one by one, so that you all may learn and all be encouraged. You see his emphasis? All are built up. All are learning. All are being encouraged. And when it comes to weighing one another, and the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets, for God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. That interesting phrase, the spirit, the prophets are subject to the spirit of the prophets, I think is Paul's way to evaluate what's being said. If a word of edification or encouragement or challenge or comfort is brought, or even a teaching, Paul says it should be in line with the prophets. Well, for Paul, that means the Old Testament prophets and their word. It also means for Paul, in line with the teaching of Jesus. Because for Paul, Jesus is always more than a prophet, but he's never less than a prophet. And what he says is prophetic. It's authoritative. It is the word of the Lord. It is what God has to say to God's people. And so whatever is said by that prophet must be evaluated. Is it in line with the biblical tradition? Is it in line with the teaching of Jesus? Does it accord with Jesus' sayings? Is it in line with preaching Christ and Him crucified, which Paul has already demonstrated is his model? Does it accord with love for others? Because without love, we're nothing. Does it accord with these certain criteria that they already have? So that Paul is essentially, for the prophets and for teachers, putting them in their place and saying, you're no better than the others. Your words should be evaluated and weighed just like anyone else's, and anyone in the congregation has the opportunity to weigh them and challenge them and wrestle through them, or even perhaps challenge them. So that there's no place for a hierarchy of, you know, this is the person, whatever they say, it's infallible. It's always true. There's no place for that in the church. It just doesn't exist. So you know for a fact when you deal with a teacher who assumes what they say is the final word on things, that they need to read their Bible better. and they need to maybe be humbled or get out of ministry altogether. So that Paul makes it clear, the prophets, one or two at a time, they're weighed by others, and when someone else is speaking, be silent. Now you see the pattern. Tongues, order, in turn, and if you're going to disorder things, be silent. Prophets, order, in turn, if you're going to disorder things, be silent. Which makes the next section, which is so controversial, at least fit into the context. Now, I'm going to read it all together, and I want you to see it, and I know you're going to have a knee-jerk reaction to it, and in some ways you should, because the way the NRSV has interpreted or translated it almost forces you to. I think they've been unhelpful in a couple of words. You ready? See the parenthesis? There's no parenthesis in the Greek. There's no periods, there's no capitals, there's no anything. This is put in by our translator, so right away we're kind of, parenthesis, what the heck? The reason why it's in parenthesis is you're going to get a little footnote at the end of the reading that says ancient authorities put verses 34 and 35 after verse 40. Which is to say, some of the Greek manuscripts have this section at the end of the chapter and not right here. So here's the section. Get ready for your knee jerk and then get ready to get over it real quickly because we want to wrestle with this. As in all the churches of the saints, women should be silent in the churches. For they are not permitted to speak, but should be subordinate or submission or in subjection, as the law also says. If there's anything they desire to know, let them ask their husbands at home. For it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Or did the word of God originate with you, or are you the only ones it has reached? Now you can see why this is controversial. You can see why when you place this according to our modern standards, if that's the first and only criteria you have of this section, you are by default going to have a knee jerk. And probably, like many of my progressive brethren, just say, hey, Paul's a misogynist. This guy just has no place for women. That's sad because you're forgetting one of the real reasons you should have a knee-jerk is this, at least on the surface, appears in contradiction to chapter 11 where he's already talked about women prophesying in the church. Do you remember that? We talked about the head coverings. You guys put on head coverings to surprise me. Paul says, hey, women can and should prophesy in the church. They need to just follow cultural decorum. That's it. That's his only little criteria that it shouldn't be a free-for-all. There should be a sense in which proper respect, proper decorum, according to the culture of its day, is expressed. But he's already made it very clear, women are speaking in the church. So that's the second reason you should have a knee-jerk. I am somewhat against the first knee-jerk, because I think if you're going to immediately assume Paul's a misogynist from a passage like this, you can do this with anyone's writing, anyone's speeches, take something out of context, and make them to be a communist, a radical, a terrorist. You can do that with anything. Instead of saying, you know, let's give Paul the benefit of the doubt. He just said women are supposed to be prophesying in the church. This is the same Paul who in Romans talked about Phoebe and Priscilla and Junia the apostle. That's a female name. He's the one who writes in Philippians to Euodia and Syntyche. There are many women in Pauline letters living and working in positions of leadership in Paul's understanding of church. So, it's very unfair to Paul to take this and say this is all he has to say when he's made it very clear he's accepted a female as an apostle. He has worked with Priscilla, who's proclaiming the gospel, and the church meets at her home. He particularly wants to talk to Euodia and Syntyche, who seem to be in charge at the Philippian church. He is very, very comfortable with women in leadership, which, by the way, in that culture, was revolutionary and far more progressive than most of the progressive things we think we're progressive about in our day. It was way liberated, way beyond what anyone else was doing. So this is that same Paul. So he must not be at least implying what on the surface it seems to be saying. So how can the context help us? How do we deal with this particular passage? Now, here's two of the unworkable answers, and then I'll give my solution. My solution is not necessarily right. You'll have to weigh it according to this passage. But it is the solution I'll give. Now, the quick and cheapest and easiest and dirtiest solution, which I completely reject out of hand, and you all know this about me, is to say, well, This must not be Pauline. Paul must not have written this. Some later conservative Pauline editor must have inserted this. He didn't quite get Paul's liberating theology. And so someone later on just kind of inserted this passage to make sure women would be oppressed and could have no say. Which, you know, begs the question, why didn't they remove chapter 11? But they didn't. So that's what some people do. In fact, people I deeply respect. Richard Hayes, I have 6 commentaries on 1 Corinthians I read to study in advance for this. Richard Hayes is my favorite. He's the top of the list. I'd recommend him to anyone. He takes this cheap and disgusting avenue. He writes, "This whole passage is much more coherent without these verses. This is the work of a subsequent Christian generation." Which is his easy way to say, someone inserted this, it's not Pauline, let's move on, there's nothing to see here. Okay? Now, that's a quick solution. I find it a little bit dishonest, and you know why? We have about 6,000 Greek manuscripts from which we get our New Testament. Manuscripts that were copied and recopied and passed down and so forth. We have about 5,000 to 6,000 extant. And these were written on papyri. And these things, you know, degenerated and degraded. We have thousands of these. Not a single one is missing this verse. And there's only a couple that insert at the end of the chapter. So the manuscript evidence, the preponderance of it is no one inserted this because we don't have any extant manuscripts where it's not there. We have a couple where it's put at the end, but we don't have any where it's not there. So I find it intellectually dishonest to just flat out say, well, someone inserted it. It really is not supposed to be there when there's no manuscript evidence to suggest that. Now, sometimes that's the case. You read the end of the Gospel of Mark. From about verses 11 on, there's a lot of manuscripts in Mark that don't have verses 12 through about verse 40 or so. And for that reason, I don't think that's inspired scripture. I don't think that's part of the sacred canon. I think that was inserted later. That's the passage that talks about they shall hold snakes and the snakes will bite them and they'll be fine and all of that. It's the source of much confusion, in my opinion, and unhelpful. So there are places legitimately where you can go back to these manuscripts and say, this wasn't in the earliest manuscripts. It was inserted later. Now, there's probably something to learn from why it was inserted later. We can study it and maybe get something from it. But then you can legitimately say, move on, there's nothing to see here. But you can't do it here. The second way to kind of bypass any problem here is to say what many will do is they'll say, this is just addressing a specific local problem. This is just a specific problem for the Corinthian church, so it has no connection for us or for the rest of the church. To which my answer to that solution is, every one of Paul's epistles is addressing a specific local problem. Are you following me? There's not a single letter he writes that's not addressed to a specific church in a specific culture in a specific context dealing with specific situations that he addresses. You can only say that when you forget that we all too quickly immediately take these and act like they're addressed to 21st century individualists in America who have enlightenment, modern tech, you know, rationales and ideals. When we forget this is a whole different world, a whole different culture. It's addressing, we too quickly apply it immediately to ourselves without recognizing there's a horizon. And we need to think about what's our unique and new horizon. In other words, what would Paul say to us who have lectionaries and have bulletins and have screens and have Bibles in our hands and all of us can read instead of only 10% and so forth? Well, you know, how would he address it? There'd be some, I guarantee, differences because he's addressing a specific local situation. So when you say, well, he's addressing a local situation and that's just that, well, you're being, I think, naive because every one of Paul's letters is addressing a local situation from which we then extrapolate, how does it apply to us? So, in moving toward what I see as the solution to this passage, I would like to suggest that one of the first things we need to do in our understanding is know there's a Greek word, gune. It's a word that can mean women or wives. There's no Greek word for wives. It's gune. It's the context that allows us to know, is the woman a wife or not? And so, when you come to this, we know in verse 34 we're dealing with wives. You know why? Verse 34, women is wives, because verse 35, if there's anything to desire to know, let them ask their an heir, their men, their husbands at home. And so all of a sudden we realize, okay, this is not addressed to womankind in general. We're dealing with a specific kind of woman, and that is a married woman in the public assembly, a married woman whose husband is also attending. And when you begin to go there, you realize, okay, that helps us begin to start to make sense of this, because the reality is, nowhere in Paul's letters and nowhere in the law are women told to be in subjection to men in general, unless you distort this one passage. Instead, women are told to be in submission to one, their husband. That was the cultural times of the day. That's how things ran. We may not be comfortable with that language, but that was the cultural norm. The woman was in submission to her husband. Now, what Paul does in Ephesians is he says, women, be subjection to your husbands. Husband, love your wives as Christ loves the church. So he ups the ante on the husband. So, you know, you can never fault Paul for being misogynist. He really ups the standards for the guys. He says, don't be a loser. Love like Christ. But here he's speaking to one women who are in subjection to one man. A woman in that day was in subjection just to her husband in the same way a slave was in subjection, not to masters in general, but to one master. If you were a slave, you didn't have to be in submission to or respect the orders of another master that wasn't your own. Only your master. Are you following me here? Because this is very important. This is not about women just in general being in submission to all of men, because it speaks about a context. It's the husband. And it's no more that then a slave would be to masters in general. So what's the issue? What's happening that's creating disorder in the church? It appears that one of two things is happening. We know that in that day, the early church was patterning itself after the synagogue. The synagogue was a place where people would come and hear the word spoken. They'd pray, they'd sing, they'd do all the things that we do in church right now. And the way they'd sit, men on one side, women on the other. So this may be one of the things that's happening, one of two. It may be that they're listening to the tongue, it's interpreted, a prophet is speaking, people are interacting one at a time, and a wife is hollering over at her husband, I'm not getting it. Or, you know, I need, you know, they're trying to chat and they're creating disorder. That may be one of the things, or it could be that maybe a husband in this particular hypothetical scenario is giving a word of prophecy, and when the weighing time comes in, the wife says, that's just crap. That's not from God. So that what should be happening at home is happening in public. Disrespect. The husband's being shamed by his spouse that's critically examining his prophecy in public, and he's all of a sudden being shamed. Or this discussion that's going on from the female side to the male side that should be happening at home is happening in the midst of church. Either way, you can see how disorder is happening. It's no longer silent. He's told the tongue-speaker, one at a time, be silent. Prophecy, one at a time, be silent. And now there's this rumbling, there's this disorder, there's this chatting, or even worse, this shaming. So it seems to me, when you put that all together, that what Paul is doing completely fits the context. Because if you think about it, he started in 26 and said, let all things be done for building up. In verse 27 and 28, tongue-speakers, one at a time, and if you don't have an interpretation, be silent. Prophets, male or female, because he's already told us in chapter 11, women can prophesy. Prophets, male or female, one at a time. And if you have an inspiration while they're speaking, shut up until they're done. And then you can talk. And then once they're done, you can then weigh. But one at a time. And if if someone else is speaking, be silent. Now he comes and says, wives, you got a question for your husband? Or you're going to publicly shame them and take what should be private and make it public, be silent. And you can see it all fits with Paul's rules of order. That's what I think is going on here. Paul is not just saying to women in general, he's saying in a specific situation with a wife and a husband where disorder may be created, where something that should be done at home is done in public. So each group is told to be silent. Each group is told to keep order and keep decorum. Each group is told not to shame the other because everyone's to build up and to encourage. And when you see it in that context, you realize, okay, I can see how this fits and how this doesn't contradict what Paul said in chapter 11 about female prophets, and it doesn't contradict what Paul says about female apostles and females in leadership and females interacting and publicly sharing their gifts in the community. It has to do with a specific problem, a specific disruption, and Paul's addressing the things that he sees that need to be taken care of so there can be order. Because for Paul, in church, there needs to be just enough order that everyone can be edified, but never too much order so that anyone is fully and finally silenced. There's a place for all to speak. And that's what that last paragraph is about. Anyone who claims to be a prophet or to have spiritual powers must, and that, here he's talking about tongues, must acknowledge that what I'm writing to you is a command of the Lord. Anyone who does not recognize this is not to be recognized. And this is Paul's way of saying, you know, I'm giving you an apostolic command. It's for your good. I'm not trying to oppress you. I want, when you're together, for everyone to be built up and encouraged. And what I've discovered as I've interacted and ministered to churches is this rule of order works. And that's how he ends. Verse 39, so my friends, be eager to prophesy. Do not forbid speaking in tongues, but all things should be done decently and in order. So this is Paul's rules of order for the Corinthian church, where some are abusing their gifts of tongues. It's leading them to pride. Some are chattering away. Some are making it so everything's unintelligible, whether it's through many people speaking in tongues without concern for anyone else, or whether it's a prophet trying to outspeak another prophet instead of speaking in turns. This is Paul's way to try to bring an order that will benefit everybody so that you have that wonderful phrase that it's done decently and in order. Well, with that said, I'll give you, as I normally do, three reflections, and then we can kind of go from there. If you have any questions, we can move in that route. The first thing I think that I find interesting from this is verse 26. When you come together, each one has something to contribute. Everyone participates in the Corinthian church. There are no spectators. They either are bringing a song or a word of comfort and encouragement of prophecy, or they're listening carefully and weighing the words. But everyone's participating. Everyone's collaboratively working together in order to better understand the gospel, to better understand their faith, so that all might be built up and encouraged, which is why it's so important to have a position like we have with Jen and Terry before her. One of the most important aspects of ministry is trying to figure out how do you discover and encourage and direct the gifts of God's people. How do you orchestrate things so that the gifts of God's people are all implemented, so that all are participating in such a way that all are being built up and all are participating in the ministry and the mission of Christ Jesus? So everyone's engaged, everyone's participating, and I find that interesting. Nobody's just spectating. Everyone is involved. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that tightrope walk of organization and organism. As I've said in this talk already, there was no printed liturgy, no bulletin, there were no Bibles in the pews. There was no, hey, let's meet at this time. It was more or less when everyone was finally there. If you've ever been in a Middle Eastern culture, you know how that works. There was much less order than we are used to. No real structure. And Paul's trying to create structure where there is none. And he does it not by giving a whole list of rules. Here's what's interesting to me. We have in the UCC a manual of ministry, which is just rules for the pastor. It's 156 pages long, people. 156 boring pages. We have a constitution that's longer than this. You know, Paul, when he talks about order, never wants to implement so much that it constricts life, that it makes it so that it's just all about the rules. He understands that an organism has structure, and without structure, the organism will fall apart. You remove the skeletons from my body, the nervous system, the structure, this organism's going to fall apart. So there's a certain amount of structure that's needed, but too much structure and I become encaged. Too much structure and you just can't even move. So Paul knows the challenge of that balance of, you know, there needs to be enough structure that life might be there and everyone's engaged and all are participating, but never so much structure that now there's no life. So that I find interesting. Paul's walking the balancing line. It may be a little bit different for us in our modern day, but he is doing his best to try to walk that tightrope. All of us lean on one of those sides more than the others. Some of us lean far more on the, oh, order is everything. We have got to follow. If we don't follow what's in the bulletin, there will be hell to pay for the pastor, because this is how it's supposed to go. And then there are some of us that lean more, and I'm on this side, hey, as long as it's, you know, something's accomplished and it's orderly to some extent, you know, to some extent, we've had a good meeting. That we're all leaning on one side or the other, and the challenge is to remember that all of those are needed. There is a sense in which we're trying to keep this body alive as an organism, to give it breathing room, to give it space, as well at the same time, give it enough structure so that that space isn't just chaos. All right? Finally, my last reflection, and I just simply call this reflection knee-jerk reactions. It's not acceptable, in my opinion, and you know this about me by now, especially if you've been with me throughout this entire time we've gone through the Bible, and perhaps the entire time I've been pastor. I never find it acceptable to look at a passage and say, I don't like it, so get rid of it. I don't see how this fits, so let's just reject it. I find that to be the coward's way, and I think a very dishonest way to handle the sacred deposit that's been given to us. We've been given a canon. It is a tradition. You don't make up the faith, it makes you. You don't make up the tradition makes you. You've been handed something, and my job as a pastor is to guard the sacred deposit of the faith, which is first and foremost the gospel according to Jesus Christ, to which this is one of the most important witnesses of that, which means when I come across passages, and there are many, where I scratch my head and say, I don't get it, I don't see how that fits, I'm not sure how that all works, my first reaction is never, well, we all know Paul was a bit of a misogynist anyway. Get rid of it. I despise that kind of engagement with Scripture. Particularly because most of the people who will say that, well, you know, I don't like that and I'll just get rid of it. It's probably not there anyway. Usually those same people will see clear passages that Paul says and say, I don't like that either. You know, he clearly says this and I don't like that. And so they write that off. Or some passages about Jesus. The Jesus Seminar, if you've ever heard of them, John Shelby Spong, a few others in the 1970s and the 1980s, these scholars would sit around and they had silver balls and black balls. And they'd read sayings of Jesus from the gospel. And if they put in a black ball after the saying, that means Jesus probably really did say that. If they put in a silver ball after it, it means Jesus probably didn't say that. That was their way to decide what Jesus said that they could tolerate. Seriously, to create a canon within the canon, to decide we like Jesus when he's not doing miracles and not talking about the Father, because that's so gender specific, and when he's not talking about, you know, some of the crazier things that have to do with eternal life. We like him when he's talking about justice. We like him when he's talking about some morals, but other than that, Jefferson did this prior to them in the 1700s, the Jefferson Bible. He got the Gospels and eliminated all the miracles, eliminated all the passages about the kingdom, and he was left with the morals, which I don't think they can stand without the resurrection, without all the rest. But he just has the Jefferson Bible. It is the canon within the canon. I find that to be such a dishonest use of a sacred tradition. Because our job in the tradition is never to pick and choose what we like. It's not a buffet we have, family. This isn't a buffet. This is the main course. This is what we live and breathe and eat and long to understand and at times wrestle deeply with and are challenged by. I would so prefer to have someone say, this is what it says and I don't like it, than for someone to say, this is what it says and I'm going to ignore it. I don't like it any day over the I'm just going to ignore it. Now, this kind of creation of a canon within a canon is not something that just crazies do. Luther, the founding father of the Protestant Reformation, wanted to get rid of Hebrew, James, and Revelation. He wanted to get rid of those books. James was an epistle of straw to him. It's something he could easily eliminate. Hebrews didn't quite get it, and Revelation, of course, he just thought that could be dropped. Calvin also had some problems with Revelation. I don't think he ever wanted it to be dropped, though. So we even have people that are soundly within the, you know, our tradition that were very ready to say, you know, we can just drop those books. And I guess my thought is, perhaps those are the books you ought to pay the most attention to, because if they really so make irate your sense of what the Bible ought to say, maybe you need to rethink what you're missing. It's like when people say, you know, read a book and then highlight it and then go back and see what you didn't highlight, because what you highlighted you were comfortable with. What you didn't highlight is probably what you ought to be reading, because that's what you need to work with and wrestle with. So my point here with the knee-jerk reactions is, instead of having a knee-jerk reaction when we come up to some bumpy places in the sacred canon, and there are plenty, how much better if we say to ourselves, how can we better understand this? How can we wrestle with this? Israel, the name Israel means one who wrestles with God. The people of God have always wrestled with God's revelation. And at the end, they are usually overtaken by it. But it's not until they've wrestled and engaged and sweated it out and worked through some of the more challenging passages, some of the more challenging teachings that they receive in the sacred tradition. So that when it comes to this tradition, it's not ours to pick and choose. It's ours to wrestle. And that's what I've tried to do with this passage, and I've tried to do with numerous other passages throughout the sacred canon, because at the end of the day, I'd rather wrestle and even end up being confused and not understanding than to simply just say, I don't like this, it doesn't fit with how I think things should be, I'm going to write it off. To me, that's not faith. That's a buffet. That's you know, pick and choose your spirituality instead of really engaging with the tradition that you don't choose. It chooses you and shapes you. Would you pray with me?